Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
So today we're going to be talking about a video about the word loaf and about a lot of bread-related topics. But before we get going, we want to talk about some follow-up. There was quite a lot of response to our previous episode on red. Thank you for the nice feedback. Quite a lot of people enjoyed it, and we really appreciated that.
We also got some interesting extra bits of evidence, words for red in other languages, which we can summarize for you.
A few people commented on Reddit about it. Victor Beer brought up the point of red wine, which we had mentioned, and pointed out that in his language, his or her language, it's not red wine, but vinaigre, black wine.
And Nash on Facebook also pointed out a similar thing, that the distinction is white and black wine. His evidence is from Georgia, the country, that is.
And there was another person on Reddit who also mentioned that in Albania, they tended to call red grapes and black grapes both black. And the color of the wine was sometimes red. It was called red wine, but the grapes were called black. And then there was a comparative discussion about whether we should call it white wine or green wine, and that there are some people who call it green wine, which of course makes some sense too.
And it is an interesting point, you know, does the color refer to the product, the wine itself, or the color of the grape?
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was quite an interesting thing that hadn't occurred to me.
And also, I think it just raises the important point that colors of many things are truly culturally determined. I mean, neither red wine nor black wine is really any more logical than the other. Some wines that are in the category of red wine truly do look red, but others look very dark to the point of looking black, and it really depends what you're looking at them in, or purple. If you're looking them in a clear glass that we look at them now, sure, they might look red with some light shining through them. But if you put it in a stoneware glass or a metal glass, it genuinely does look black.
Yeah.
And what we think of it as being, you know, very few of us sit and think about what color the wine actually is, unless you're a connoisseur or thinking about it from a sort of wine tasting point of view. It's just red wine because it's red wine, and that's the category. Or, in another language, black wine. And I think that's a good illustration of what some of what we were talking about and what we'll talk about in the future, I'm sure, when we're talking about color, that color is not just a matter of wavelengths.
And, of course, white wine is by no definition white.
Yeah, that's true. There is no white wine that is white.
It's yellow. White wine is
yellow or green.
Or a little bit. It can be a little bit green. If you're talking about the grape, then certainly the grape is green.
But yeah, and none of them are purely clear either, even. If you wanted to pretend that white
was clear. Yeah, there's no clear.
Perfectly clear white wine.
Mm-hmm. So.
And then also on Reddit, there was brought up some languages that do have multiple words for red. Specifically in Catalan, and I'm not going to pronounce these correctly, roig, cognate to red, and vermel, cognate to vermilion, are apparently, I'm just going off what the commentator said, what Victor Beer said, are pretty much the same color, and it's dialectal, so different places will use one as the main word and the other as a secondary word and vice versa in other regions. So that is like Czech and Hungarian, which seem to be the other languages that have doublets for red.
Right.
And then the other one was on Twitter, Urwe, I guess. Again, don't know how to pronounce everybody's names. Pointed out that Turkish has three words for red. You want to try pronouncing them?
Kirmizi, kizil, and al.
Mm-hmm. And I looked it up in Wikipedia and on a website about the Turkish language, and it sort of suggests that there's a kind of a chronological thing going on here. So the site that I found out talked about the Turkish language, and I can't swear to its accuracy, says the old Turkish words for red, al, and white, ak, are mostly used in place names and family names. So al sancak, red banner, alkan, Mr. Red Blood, things like that. Otherwise, the word kirmizi is used for red. And then it says also that the word kizil means red-colored, but is only used in certain situations, like to describe the Red Sea, or infrared, or red-haired, or the Red Crescent, or the Red River. So it's a very specified So I wonder if that means that there were different words for red at different periods that kind of get fossilized into place names or person names or particular collocations, but that, what is it, Kirmizi is the more, at least currently, the basic word. And I'd be interested to know if that's correct.
And I'm guessing that Kirmizi is related to Kermes.
Right, that was the word for the bug?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, so maybe I'll be connected to that. We haven't really looked that up, but yeah. Anyway, that was some interesting feedback. So thank you for that and some other byways to look at. I also had a friend on Twitter, Joe Van Every, mention a book called A Perfect Red, which is apparently a history of red dye, especially cochineal. And she says it's well written. So I haven't read that or taken a look at it yet, but I'll pass on that recommendation. So the book is A Perfect Red. And I can imagine that being quite interesting. The history of various dyes and pigments that have been used can be quite fascinating. I read an article today about the history of ultramarine, the paint pigment, and it's got some interesting history. But I'll save that for another day. Because we will talk about more color terms. We definitely heard that people enjoyed us talking about color and would like us to talk more about colors. So we're going to continue through, not the rainbow exactly, but probably sort of through the linguistic grid of colors. But we'll spread them out a little bit. I don't know whether we'll do green or yellow or blue next. Those are the next sort of rank of
That's
colors.
That's the next range of them. So
we'll decide one of those. Yeah. And I just want to say we will definitely do purple. Not yet. Quite possibly I will keep it for the crowning color, since that seems appropriate to its royal connections. But believe me, there is no power on earth that would stop me from talking about purple. But we will get to it later. We're not going to talk about it immediately. Oh, there was one just last thing that I think was perhaps a useful point. Nash Mahoney on Facebook mentioned about the basic color words that I had said there are basic color words and then there are color words that are referential, that refer, you know, sky blue or something like that, and that we don't think of those as basic color words. And he corrected me appropriately that sometimes terms that start off referential do become the basic color word.
Yeah.
And so that when there's a light blue, and that is called a particular term in Georgian, which means sky color, but it is now the basic term for that blue. There is no other term for it. And that's, of course, quite right. And in English, the obvious ones to point to are pink and orange, which we will talk about later in this series, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Both of which started out referring to something, but now there is no other basic term. So that's a good point to clarify. It's not that they're all basic terms can't be referential.
And that seems to be the case in a number of other languages as well. Mm-hmm. That seems to be pretty a common phenomenon that a basic color term can arise out of a referential.
Right. My point at the time was more that if there is a basic term and referential color terms, then the one that's not referential is more likely to be the basic term. But there's lots of other situations. Okay, that really is everything, I think, for follow-up. So, what are we going to be talking about today, Mark? Oh, no. Drinks.
Ah.
Okay, I'll talk about my drink first because it's completely pointless. I could not think of a bread-themed cocktail. They really could not come up with anything. So, for reasons that will, sort of become apparent in that I'm going to be talking about Roman things, which is no surprise to anyone, I chose to make something with an Amaro and Cinzano. And just blended those half and half. So it's a sort of bitters drink, which is an Italian drink. And that's all. And that's as themed as it got.
And I decided to go for beer, since beer is going to come up in our discussion related to bread, obviously, from the way it's produced. So the particular beer that I'm drinking is made by our local craft brewery here in Sudbury, Stack Brewing. And I think this is my favorite of their. They have a whole range of different styles of beer they make. I think this one is probably my favorite. It's Les Portes de l'Enfer. It's a strong beer, nice and sweet and malty. So I think that's appropriate for a bready conversation.
Much more than my drink is, for sure. All right, Chin-chin.
Cheers.
And now, Mark, what are we going to be talking about today?
Well, this is from one of the videos from early on, and it's all about the word loaf and then more broadly, how bread, is kind of a metaphor or a common feature of culture and society as a pillar of society. I guess you could say the staff of life is the expression. And I want to sort of apologize a little bit in advance. As I say, this is one of the early videos. The pacing is kind of quick.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, I'm afraid you'll have to use your loaf to keep up with the pace. My apologies both for the pacing and the terrible joke.
Just wait, there's more of those coming.
There's more of those coming. Yeah, we settled down into a slightly more relaxed pace in more recent videos, but this one is a bit quick.
Okay, so we'll play the Loaf soundtrack and take a listen, and then we'll come back and discuss what we talked about in that and a lot more bread-related issues.
Bread is famously referred to as the staff of life because of its importance to many civilizations around the world. It literally supports the lives of people just as it figuratively supports the civilizations they come from. In fact, it's so important that it's formed the basis of social structures, transformed taxation systems, and even overthrown governments. But the earliest use of the word bread in English is not to refer to the baked good we know today, but instead more generally to refer to a morsel or piece of food, any food really. What we think of now as bread was originally referred in Old English, and in other Germanic languages, with a word related to our modern English word loaf, hlaf in its Old English form. We now use the word loaf to refer to bread of a particular shape, but originally it was a general term for bread. As we'll see, a look at the word loaf as well as other bread words and expressions will reveal a lot about the importance of bread to history and culture. Both loaf and bread are particularly Germanic words coming to us from Proto-Germanic roots. Though we can't trace loaf back any further, there are two possible origins for the word bread. One is that it comes from a Proto-Indo-European word which meant to boil or to bubble, a root which also gives us words such as brew, broth, brood, breed, ferment, and fervent. This obviously refers to the leavening of bread, like when you add yeast to make it fluffy and full of bubbles. Hence also the connection to the word brew, like when you add yeast to make beer. The other possible origin is to a Proto-Indo-European root meaning break, cut, or pierce. This would make sense with the earlier use of bread to mean piece of food. It's possible that our word bread comes from a conflation of both these sources. These Germanic-derived words suggest the importance of bread to ancient and medieval Germanic culture in particular. As the Roman Empire came into more and more contact with the various Germanic tribes along their northern borders, the Roman writer Tacitus composed an ethnographic description of these foreign peoples and their strange customs, strange to Roman minds anyways. He used the Latin word comitatus to describe the way they organized their heroic warrior culture, a term still used by scholars today. The comitatus was the band of warriors who followed a particular lord or king. They would live in the lord's hall, and he would provide them with all the necessities, food, a lot of alcohol, weapons, and other treasure. For their part, the warriors owed absolute loyalty to their lord, and would follow him into battle to win loot, all of which they then handed over to their lord, who then redistributed it among the warriors. Thus, a lord's generosity, not only his bravery and strength, was crucial for maintaining social order. And the key to this is in the word lord, or hlaford in Old English, which etymologically speaking is a contraction of loaf ward, meaning, in other words, keeper of the bread. The ward part of loaf ward is related to the words guard and guardian. The lord's wife, the lady, or hlaftia in Old English, is important too, meaning literally loaf maker. The second part of the word is related to an Indo-European root that means to form or build, and also gives us the words dough and dairy. The first part of the word dairy originally meant female doughmaker, then eventually any kind of female worker or servant such as a dairymaid, and more specifically the production of milk and cheese. Then, with the addition of the re part on the end, it referred to the building where she worked, and finally the stuff produced there, as in our modern word dairy. But in early Germanic society, the terms lord and lady reflected metaphorically the crucial role they played in providing the staff of life for the comitatus. Bread was a symbol of the whole socio-political structure. A similar idea can be found in the word companion, which comes from the Latin com, with, and panis, bread, so someone you eat bread with, thus a close and important relationship. Oh, and while we're on the topic of early Germanic terms for kings, in Old English poetry, the king or lord is often referred to as a baggifa, literally ring-giver, again because of the importance of generosity to the comitatus. The lord gives gold arm rings and other treasure to his followers. The first part of that word bag, meaning ring, is related to the word bagel, a ring-shaped bread. So you might say that in the Old English epic poem Beowulf, the hero Beowulf is rewarded with bagels for going to Denmark to stop the man-eating monster Grendel from eating all the Danishes. Bread, of course, also commonly features in religion as well, such as the unleavened bread matzo which Jewish people eat during Passover, commemorating the story of the flight from slavery in Egypt when the Israelites didn't have time to allow the bread to rise and so ate it unleavened. And of course in Christian tradition, the story of the Last Supper of Christ leads to the sacrament of eating bread representing the body of Christ as part of the Eucharist, which is also reflected in the expression to break bread, a communal activity. kind of gives new meaning to the idea of the Lord's Prayer, or as we now know, the Loaf Guardian's Prayer, when it asks, "Give us this day our daily bread." Naturally, bread has been a major force in political history as well, and we refer to an important grain-producing region metaphorically as a breadbasket. For instance, Egypt was crucially important to the grain supply for ancient Rome. In fact, it was unusual in that no member of the highest senatorial class was allowed to be governor of Egypt, because cutting off the grain supply to Rome would be a perfect way to try and overthrow an emperor and become one yourself. Riots over grain shortages in the city were a constant factor in determining who became or stayed emperor. After all, the grain supply to Rome was so important that it was personified as the goddess Annona. The Roman satirist Juvenal criticizes the easily distracted Roman populace by saying that they can be bought off by politicians with bread and circuses, panem et circenses. In later medieval England, well after the Anglo-Saxon period, during the reign of Henry III in the 13th century, the assize of bread and ale was enacted to regulate the price, weight, and quality of bread and ale produced and sold, the first law in England to control food production and sale. Remember the connection between bread and ale? This led to the practice of the baker's dozen, giving 13 loaves for the price of 12, so that bakers who had the reputation of being frequently dishonest could be sure to avoid the harsh penalties if some of their loaves were slightly underweight, penalties which could include being dragged around town with the bad loaves around your neck, or even having a hand amputated. This law also led to the job of ale conner, a tester of the quality of ale. Now this might seem like a pretty sweet job, but given that ale often went off, and that imposing fines might make one unpopular, people often had to be drafted into the role. One unfortunately apocryphal story is that ale conners would test the ale not by tasting it, but rather by sitting in a trough of it while wearing leather trousers, whose stickiness afterwards indicated the alcohol content. I think I'd rather taste it. As a side note, William Shakespeare's father, John, once held the post of ale conner. And then, in 19th century Britain, the Corn Laws, protectionist tariffs benefiting domestic grain producers, were brought in and drove up the price of bread, leading to political turmoil and rioting. A demonstration against the Corn Laws was violently broken up by the government forces in the famous Peterloo Massacre. These laws, combined with grain shortages due to the year without a summer, caused by a number of coincidental volcanic eruptions around the globe, most notably Mount Tambora in Indonesia, led to widespread hunger and even starvation. The Corn Law controversy came down to conflicting interests between traditional grain-producing landowners and the new industrialists. Enacted by a Tory government led by Lord Liverpool, the Corn Law's repeal by a later Prime Minister, Robert Peel, effectively ended that man's tenure as Prime Minister because he was breaking with traditional conservative policy supporting the landowners by instead favouring free trade. So bread is a basic necessity of life in many cultures, and its symbolic importance has been extended in modern usage to many bread-related metaphors for money. For instance, since the 18th century, bread can refer to one's livelihood, and since the 1950s to money itself, while since the 19th century, dough can refer to money, and don't forget the connection between dough and the second element of lady. Similarly, the breadwinner earns the money, first attested in the 19th century, and thus likely knows which side his bread is buttered on, 16th century, that is, where his best interests lie. If he's unlucky, someone might take the bread out of his mouth, 18th century, but if he's very lucky, his bread might be buttered on both sides, 19th century. And since Otto Friedrich Rohwedder invented a machine that automatically slices and wraps bread in 1928, we refer to a great innovation as the greatest thing since sliced bread. When you think about it, this is the final dramatic step in a remarkable process which took bread from the central unifying element in society, as evidenced by the loaf-lord connection, through industrialization to convenience food, since we don't even need to slice our own bread anymore. But it shows us that bread is still important to us since we compare all other progress to how happy we are to have our bread pre-sliced for us. So in this video, I've asked you to use your loaf to follow a trail of breadcrumbs from the Anglo-Saxon Loaf Guardian to the Wonder Bread of modern times, sandwiching the juicy filling of history inside the dry crust of etymology, to find that bread has a role much bigger than a bread box in the world as we know it. And on that note, I think this video is toast.
I did mention the bad puns, right?
I think I'm going to taste some beer.
How? Drinking or sitting in it?
No. I'm going to taste it.
It really was very quick, wasn't it?
It was. My head is spinning, and it's not the beer.
And you wrote that. Right. So there's a bunch of stuff in there that I'm reminded of that is interesting about the cultural role. But do you want to start? Is there anything you want to add or pick up on of the etymological stuff?
Well, some additional etymologies, I guess. I wanted to draw attention to the sort of what's called the narrowing of senses. The word loaf, originally meaning bread, generally gets narrowed to meaning a hunk of bread, right? A piece of baked bread. Similarly, bread itself had a broader meaning of
food.
Food, yeah. And meat, similarly, having a broader meaning
Just food.
Of food. Starve having a broader meaning of to die, and then getting narrowed to mean to die of lack of food. Mm-hmm. So this is a general principle. This is one of the semantic changes that can often happen, this narrowing of sense.
Okay.
Meat, by the way, and I guess I've mentioned this in a video recently, comes from the Proto-Indo-European root met, meaning measure. It's this idea of a time, a communal time for sharing food, a sort of appointed time.
Mm-hmm.
And mate, the word mate as in a companion,
yes.
Comes from meat. So it's this idea of sharing food.
Right.
So all of this sort of ties into this notion of bread as this kind of, you know, really central communal activity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The word companion, by the way, which I mentioned, I guess, in the video, is probably a translation of a Germanic word. It comes from the Franks. It's used initially in, I think, a Latin context, but it's probably a translation of a Germanic word that is related to the loaf word.
Right.
Probably something along the lines of Gothic gachleiba, which means messmate, from the Germanic root chleib, or loaf of bread.
Okay.
And some other bready etymologies for you. This was a bit of a surprise to me. Flour and flour. We you know, make this distinction between flour, the milled grain, and mm-hmm. flour, the part of the flour. Etymologically, they're the same word. And the spelling mm-hmm. distinction to tell them apart was a relatively recent invention.
Really?
Yeah, it only started in the 18th century, and it wasn't really regularized until about 1830 that it became really distinct, the two different flours.
That does surprise me. I'm surprised I didn't know it, mm-hmm. as well as being surprised by the fact.
The notion is that flour, the grain, the milled mm-hmm. grain,
mm-hmm.
is the sort of choice part,
okay.
right? So
yeah.
like the flour is the choice
the
part
bran.
Of the plant.
Yeah. Yeah, like the metaphorical use of flour of a generation, that kind of
idea. Exactly,
yeah. Oh, okay.
And both words are related to blossom.
Huh, the FB?
Yeah, the FB. So blossom, all the B-related words, the B cognates there, come through the Germanic side. Flower comes through, well, flora in Latin,
right.
if you think
right.
about it. So that comes through the Latin side and comes into English through French.
Right.
So blossom, it comes from this Proto-Indo-European root bell, which means it's sort of a growing, blossoming word, right?
Okay.
And it also produces blood mm-hmm. and bless through blood, because bless means originally blooding.
Right.
So referring to some
sacrifice.
Sort of ritual sacrifice or something like that.
Huh. Okay.
Bake.
Mm-hmm.
From bake, we get the word batch, by the way. A batch is...
A bake, yeah.
A thing that's been baked.
Yeah, and at bakers, we'll talk about a bake as a noun.
Right.
Like a batch of bread that has been baked, or a batch
yeah.
of, you know, of...
Well,
whatever.
Literally, a batch mm-hmm. is a bake.
Right.
And it comes from a Proto-Indo-European root that means to warm, and
makes
gives
sense.
Us also bathe and bath.
Okay.
As well as a Greek word, phogein. Do you know this word?
It's not sure.
It means to roast.
Okay.
So it's interesting that, you know, these cooking methods that mm-hmm. we think of as being so radically different, baking, cooking with water, and mm-hmm. roasting.
All just come from something that means make hot.
Make hot, yes.
Which at root, of course, they all are, yeah.
And since I've mentioned flour, one last baking etymology for us. Meal. Not mm-hmm. as in the appointed time of eating.
No, but as in wholemeal flour, which is how what we would call whole wheat flour here is usually referred to in British cookbooks, I think.
It's a completely unrelated word.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from a root that means soft, and may be related to the word malt, which brings us back to beer.
Oh, okay.
So that gives us a number of bread and beer
related words
on the mind.
All right, well, let me add in, just to go back to the Latin panis, which means bread.
Yeah.
And that comes from just the basic word pasco, to feed.
Ah.
So it just means thing you feed on.
Right, so again,
it just means food.
Again, mm-hmm. it's that narrowing yeah. of meaning.
Yeah. And then to parallel a little bit the idea of companion and companion and the other words that stress the communal aspect of eating mm-hmm. as a something that causes you to have a tie with someone else. One of the words for a type of marriage ceremony in a Roman marriage ceremony is the confariatio, which just literally means con together, and fari is the farium, a barley cake, from the word far, which means barley,
right?
Which is related mm-hmm. to barley, obviously. There, that's that FB again,
right?
So a barley cake, which is the sort of most primitive form of bread for the Romans. There's a whole hierarchy of grains for Romans and Greeks, but barley is way down at the bottom. But it was one of the earliest ones that they thought themselves to have used. And so barley cakes are used in ceremonial and religious ritual. And so the eating together of, or the exchange of barley cakes was a type of marriage ceremony. So there you have that idea that coming together to share bread has a strong symbolic meaning.
This suddenly made me think the French word for flour
mm-hmm.
is...
Farine. It must just be the same thing from barley. Yeah. Farina.
Yeah, from farina. Yeah. So it is indeed. Yeah, there you go.
There's a whole bunch of words on the far root in Latin.
Right, okay.
With barley. As it does show the sort of primacy of, in spite of the fact that wheat and spelt, other types of wheat and emmer and other types of grains were the more commonly used in the classical and even essentially the historical period, barley clearly has a basic level of importance to the whole Mediterranean world, both the Greek and the Roman world. Even though by the Roman period, for instance, the Roman army refused to eat barley, it was punishment rations and things like that. But it was still one of the basic grains.
So is it an older grain from a previous time that was more central, I guess? Is that
well,
the idea?
Well, it grows, it's easier to grow than wheat.
Right.
And it grows in some poorer soils. Now, Italy has a lot of very good arable land, and so it was better able to grow wheat and older, there are a bunch of older versions of wheat. The type of wheat that we use now is not the common, and spelt was a type of grain that was a sort of wheat that was used. Greece couldn't grow wheat very well, so
they
grew
they
a lot more barley.
Land, do they?
Yeah, so they grew a lot more barley, so they were less dismissive of it. They still saw wheat as a higher prestige grain, but barley was a much more commonly used.
Right.
But by the Roman period, it's around, but if you can import wheat or grow wheat, that's better. You prefer it. But for people in large parts of the Mediterranean, it probably just depended what you could grow, what your particular area grew, and so your bread was made with whatever grain was appropriate to your growing circumstances. But for people in Rome itself who had access to grain from other places, wheat was the grain of choice. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about the annona, for instance, the free grain distribution that started in the late Republic and became really, really important in the empire, that was wheat, not, as I thought for a very long time until finally my brain caught up with me, corn. Because I would just like to point out something important, which is that the word corn to a North American ear is very specific. It means maize, which we never use as a word for it. But to a British ear, or at least at one point, I don't know if that's true anymore, but for a long time, the word corn simply meant, and here we have again a narrowing effect, corn meant grain.
Grain.
It was
any
an all-purpose
grain. Yeah.
Term for grain. So it was a very useful term to refer to any kind of grain. And so in translations of Latin texts that I used to read when I was studying it, they would always refer to corn, to the corn supply, to corn ships, to corn dole, to the importance of corn.
So you're picturing these Romans sitting around eating corn on the cob or something.
Of course, I know that they don't have corn, but you know how your brain, doesn't necessarily connect the dots. You know, when I was translating, it just sort of never occurred to me that they didn't. And of course, the Italians have corn. So I don't know. It just never struck me until one day I sort of looked at it and went, wait a minute. They don't have corn. What are they talking about? And then found out that corn did not mean what I thought corn meant and that I had to replace all of it with grain. And then it would all make sense. So that was just a couple of little words to show the importance of bread to the Romans. Though both the Romans and Greeks and many Mediterranean cultures also ate a lot of grain in non-bread forms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they certainly did eat bread, but something that's sort of more like a polenta or a porridge or, you know, a boiled grains boiled in milk or water.
Gruel, basically.
Gruel, yeah. You know, often with vegetables or spices added or flavorings added or cheese.
So fancy gruel.
Yeah. But was a very, very common way of eating grain, which was the basic staple, right, along with pulses for both Romans and Greeks. Because one of the things about baking bread is it does require slightly more complicated capture of heat. Now, you can bake hearth breads on a sort of a slab or on a sort of like a pancake or an English muffin or something like that, where you pour dough onto a pan, or you put dough on a rock next to the fire and it cooks. So you can do it without a proper oven. But good bread, especially leavened bread, really requires an oven. And that's fairly energy intensive and complicated to have. Like a poor house in a tenement apartment in Rome is not going to have an oven.
Now, did they have communal ovens that you could bring your bread to bake?
Because to my knowledge, and I was looking this up because I was wondering about that, I did not see anyone talking about communal ovens. Commercial ovens, especially in the Roman period, somewhat in the Greek period in big cities, but in particular in the Roman period, bakeries became a major commercial enterprise. So there were large bakeries, and we have evidence of bakeries at Rome and a lot of evidence for bakeries at Pompeii, where they milled their own flour. So a bakery would have a mill and ovens and clearly baked bread for selling, and sometimes selling out of the shop. And then often it looks like they didn't have shop windows. They were delivering, you know, so they were sort of bringing bread to people.
Right.
So that definitely is a thing. I couldn't find any evidence for the kind of ovens that I know there were in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, yeah.
Where there was an oven where you could mix your own dough, bring it, and have it baked in an oven. I can't rule it out, but I didn't see any mention of it.
Now, this is one of these things about the Middle Ages that it's a broad generalization. I don't know anything about the
when
specifics.
And where and, yeah,
yeah, I mean, it's presumably at certain times in the Middle Ages, which is a 1,000-year period, in certain places.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that I've heard generally said about, in the Middle Ages, that there were communal ovens that you could bring your breads to, to do the baking. And therefore, you wouldn't have to have, every household would not have to have an oven. But yeah, it's these sorts of things that drive the formation of medieval towns, is having things like communal mill. Mm-hmm. So you bring your grain. You don't mill it yourself. You bring it to the miller to do the milling for you, and then you have your flour, and you mix up your bread, and then you take it to the communal oven and bake your bread.
Yeah, and again, as far as I know, that communal milling is not a thing in the ancient world, and I would be happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I have not seen it mentioned. Now, of course, we don't have water powered mills. There were animal powered mills. So in Rome, in particular, we have donkey-powered and also slave-powered, where slaves would walk around in a circle pushing the millstone.
Which always makes me think of, you know, these sorts of contraptions of the Flintstones, you know, some animal.
No, they're not
turning
in
the.
Yeah, it's not quite that elaborate or dinosaur involving, but but those big commercial mills seem to have been commercial, and it doesn't seem like people could have brought their own grain. And I think that's also because you only find those commercial mills in the cities. And in the cities, people don't grow, you know, you don't have farmers growing their own grain.
Right.
What you have is you get your grain allotment, as we were just talking about, your free grain, if you're a poor class to get that. But they seem to have mostly ground it at home. But I don't know that for sure. It may have been possible to get your grain ground for you, because grinding grain was always has been in all parts of the world, a highly labor-intensive thing.
Yeah.
And that's one of the, in the archaic periods of Rome and Greece, you see that as being characterized along with wool working as the primary tasks of women that are then taken over by slaves as the slave economy gets going. And that, you know, is the thing that takes up so much of their time. So much of a woman's time was spent grinding grain and spinning wool. You know, those just took up their life because they're so labor intensive. I had a couple of other things I wanted to mention about bread before we get to perhaps talking about our own baking. One of the nice points about bread and its importance is in Greek literature and in poetry, you see a distinction made between the men and gods on the terms of bread.
Right.
So men who eat bread, as opposed to gods who eat ambrosia or nectar or who simply don't eat. So men who eat bread is a phrase that you'll find as a description of mortals. That's how you distinguish mortals from the immortals, because they eat bread. And it also is a communal term. It's a term, it means in the sense everyone eats bread. So when you're talking about the whole world, a way of describing all people is all people who are civilized is men who eat bread.
Right.
So you can distinguish them from the gods. You can also distinguish them from barbarians or semi-humans like centaurs or something who don't eat bread.
Non-agricultural.
Mm-hmm. Either mythical or at the far reaches of the geographical world. People who don't eat bread. Yeah. So that just shows that primacy again. Do you have anything else you wanted to specifically add?
Well, we're going to get to bread making and I mm-hmm. suppose also beer making.
Mm-hmm.
And so I neglected to mention in my list of bready terms some beer-related words, so I may as well throw those in as well. Beer, of course, comes from Latin, actually, bibera, to drink.
Right.
And so it gets borrowed into early Germanic from Latin and becomes the word beer. But it's not the common, it's not the original main word for the drink. It was more commonly referred to as ale.
Right.
That's the older word.
Right.
And ale has a magical, or it's presumed to come from a root that has magical connotations. If you've seen our most recent video or collaboration of videos in the sister video to ours, we hear about the Alu runic inscription appearing everywhere. It's the most common runic inscription, and it literally means ale. Why would you write ale on a whole bunch of things? Well, it's probably because it has this magical connotation. It's some sort of protective magical spell or something.
So beer is magic is what you're saying.
Beer is magic, yes. And so anyone who's the solution to and no, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
In the immortal words of Homer.
Yes.
Not the one.
Not that Homer.
Okay.
And on that note, I'm going to drink a little bit more of my ale.
Okay, so the thing I wanted to turn to is just something we've been doing recently. I've always enjoyed baking bread myself from very young age. I got into bread baking and have recently restarted it with sourdough bread. And that can bring us to one of the, you talk about leavened versus unleavened breads and about yeast. But of course, one of the important things about bread in historically, first of all, has been, yes, whether it's leavened or not. And leavened means that it has a rising agent. And through most of history, a rising agent has meant yeast. In the last 150 years, maybe a little more, there's been other leavening agents like baking powder and baking soda that can, but those are industrial products. Those are not things in those forms anyway.
Do you have any idea how they were originally produced?
The short answer is no.
No,
I've read a little bit about them, but I don't remember the details. I'd have to look into it. I have a feeling that soda was used in certain ways first. And I certainly know that baking soda was used before baking powder. Baking powder is the more complex form
right.
of it.
Okay.
Don't know exactly when soda started being used. Maybe it's older. So no, I'd have to go and
I'm going to have to look that up. That's a really interesting point.
But it certainly is one of the big things that changed cakes, modern
right.
cake.
Okay. Yeah.
What we think of in North America in particular as cake. And
right.
that's one of the reasons there's such a big distinction between North American cakes and European cakes, traditional European cakes. Traditional European cakes are leavened usually only with egg.
Right.
Whereas the North American cake is baking powder. And that's a huge distinction. But getting back to bread, until fairly recently when quick breads became a thing with baking soda and baking powder, if a bread was leavened, it was with yeast. And getting yeast, again, until fairly recently, when industrial processes you could make yeast in large quantities and dry it and ship it to people and you could buy it, as one does now, yeast that is in a little packet that you just add to your bread, that is a very relatively new thing. To get yeast in the past, there were pretty much two ways of doing it. One, you capture wild yeast from the air by putting food that can be turned into yeast together. Usually you mix a little bit of flour and water together, You leave it out until it starts to bubble, and now you've got sourdough. You've got a starter. You've got yeasts and bacteria working together, and it's the yeast that produce the leavening, and the bacteria produce a souring taste, which is fine and nice. And that, if you can, you keep adding a little more flour and water to it, you can use part of it to rise a bread and keep part of it and keep adding flour and water to it.
So you keep your sourdough as a little ongoing colony, as a as a kind of a pet.
Yeah, exactly. There's ways of doing it so you don't have to keep feeding it. You can just refresh it every time, but that's all technical. You don't have to worry about that. And that way of making yeast and making leavened bread is, I'm sure, the oldest and would happen simply by accident, just like all initial discoveries of yeast and leavening and fermentation, I think. It's a type of fermentation, in other words. And you can keep your sourdough going, but you can also restart a sourdough. So you can do it at any time. And that is the most common way, is surely how a lot of breads were made that were leavened throughout history. The other way of doing it is to start with some other substance that will ferment and then take the yeast that forms as a byproduct of that and use it to start a sourdough or to raise your bread. And there's apparently, that was what the Romans did, was they would take the yeast that they used that was a sort of a byproduct of fermentation of wine. So the yeast that forms in the must, the grape juice, and there's kind of yeast left over, you can kind of get the chunky bits right. afterwards. And they would use that to start a yeast, and then you could use that to make your bread.
And presumably you could do the same with beer.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure other places did it with beer. And in fact, certainly I know that in various periods, people have used beer yeast to make bread. And that goes back and forth. And then you can use bread yeast to start beers, too, both ways.
Now, this is something we haven't experimented with.
No, and I think general practices today discourage it, that the yeasts that make good breads are not the same as the yeasts that make good beers. Partly that's because we use different grains for the two of them. And so the yeasts that live on one grain are less likely to be useful for another grain. But I'm sure you could do it.
I suppose if you were making a barley bread, using a beer yeast might be... We've gotten
very precious. I mean, we as a culture have gotten very precious about our beer yeasts. You know, we have very specific types of strains of yeast for every specific... We make beer at home, too, by the way. I should point that out. Very specific strains of yeasts for very particular flavors and types of beers. But, you know, those strains of yeast are a product of the local yeasts in any given place that then became associated with that style of beer. They were always wild yeasts to start off with. So, you know, we could easily try making a batch of beer if we wanted with bread yeast, with our sourdough yeast, just to see what happened. It might not
taste
like...
Or the other way around.
Yeah, or the other way around. It might not taste like the particular style of beer we wanted it to be or whatever. It might not taste great, but it would ferment.
Presumably would work, yeah.
It would produce alcohol. So, yeah, we could try that sometime. Maybe with a small batch or something.
Small batch. I'd like to try it the other way around, actually. Take the...
The beer yeast and try to make a sourdough yeast or raise bread with it.
And in fact, take the, you know, the leftover sediment at the end.
Ooh, the sludge.
Yeah. And use that as your starter to make...
To make a batch. Yeah, that'd be interesting. When you say barley bread, one of the things about barley and one of the reasons it was disliked by the ancient world is that it has very little, if any, gluten in it.
Ah.
So one of the reasons the wheat has always been or has often been the primary and sort of most sought after of the grains for bread making is that it has the most gluten by far of any of the other grains. And therefore, and gluten is the protein that forms the sort of stickiness that captures the air. So when yeast is added to bread, it produces carbon dioxide, which produces bubbles. If there's no gluten, the bubbles just go out the dough and the dough doesn't rise.
And so it's dense.
So it's dense and you could add as much yeast as you want. It's not going to make much difference if it's purely barley. But if you have wheat, it produces a stretchy fibers which trap the air, and that's what makes it rise and get fluffy. But you can make a part barley, part wheat bread, or something like that. So yeah, we could try that sometime. So we made a sourdough that we just started flour and water together. In fact, my dad did it when he was visiting, and we've been keeping the sourdough going. I've been making a loaf a week usually. And recently I thought I would try, because I saw a video demonstrating how to do this, try making a loaf of bread that replicated, at least in shape, the bread quite famously found in the ovens at Pompeii. because some bread was left in the ovens by fleeing bakers and carbonized. And so we have loaves from Pompeii of sort of solidified bread. And we have a picture, in fact. I mean, there are many pictures available on the internet, but we have a picture from the Pompeii exhibit that was at the ROM in Toronto last summer. We took a picture of one of these loaves.
And so we know exactly what a Roman or Pompeian, anyways.
Yeah, one type of Pompeian.
One type of Pompeian bread made by one particular baker, what that loaf is shaped like. And, mm-hmm. and you can sort of reverse engineer what the mechanics of producing it is.
Mm-hmm. So I tried doing that, and I used the sourdough because that would be presumably the sourdough starter we have, because that would be presumably the kind of yeast they would have used would be a sourdough. And I didn't have spelt flour on hand, and I do want to try it again with spelt. So I used a combination of whole wheat flour, white flour. And of course, in the ancient world, the whiter the flour, the higher the prestige, just in, like in the Middle Ages. So rich people could use white flour. The poorest people had just the bran left over. And of course, bran doesn't have any gluten in it, so you can't, so you basically have to make a porridge with it. So I used whole wheat flour and white flour, and I put a couple of tablespoons of semolina, which is a coarsely ground wheat that the Romans definitely had and used in it, and raised it. And then I did what the chef that tried to recreate this did, which is tied a string around it once it had risen, so it was circular, and he tied a string around it, which makes this sort of indentation around the side of it. And the reason he did that is because the Pompeian loaves that we have this indentation, and he was trying to figure out how. I'll put a link to the video that I used as a source for this in the show notes, how this line would be formed, because it doesn't really look like from a pan. That doesn't fit, doesn't make sense. And he decided it was probably from a string, and that you might do that partly to keep the shape of the loaf as it rose in the oven, and partly to produce something that you could then hang or carry, because it would have a string attached to it. So once the loaf was baked, it's already got a carrying handle.
So presumably you could hang it in the shop, and you go and you buy your loaf and then
carry it home. It actually makes, I had not heard that theory before, but I thought it was great. So I did that. I tied the string around it. And then the Pompeian loaf is divided into 8 segments with deep cuts along the top to mark out 8 segments. So I did that. And I baked it in the oven with just a Corningware dish over top of it for the first 15 minutes to keep it sort of soft, stop it from getting a really hard crust, and to help it keep its shape so that it didn't spread too far. And also because several Roman recipes we have talk about using a terracotta dome over top of bread to bake it. And I don't have that, but this was a pretty good substitute. And so I baked that, and it turned out, I think, really good. It was very tasty, and I think the semolina really helped make it tasty. It looked very much like the Pompeian loaf, and, you know, given that it was made with similar ingredients and a sourdough, I thought it was not that far off of authentic.
So we'll post pictures side by side of the original Pompeian loaf and the recreation, and you can judge for yourself. But yeah, it was very successful, I thought.
Yeah, so I definitely want to keep trying, playing around with that. I want to try a part spelt, at least, version of it, just to see what that tastes like. We had it on a couple of nights ago, this bread, with another Roman recipe, which was for patina of sole, which was sole, the fish, poached, and then you add it poached with various flavorings, and then you add egg to it and put it back in the oven and bake it into sort of an omelette-y thing, and asparagus on the side. And it was really quite a delicious dinner. That's really the point I wanted to bring up is I wanted to tell that story about the Roman bread, but also about bread making, how it's worked and how it's changed over time. The bread that we eat now, I mean, it shares the fact that it is made from grains with bread throughout the ages, but it's actually quite different for a number of reasons from the bread that has fed most of the world through, or places that eat bread, because not everyone eats bread or has eaten bread in the past. But the bread we eat now is quite different from most of the bread that has fed most of the people who eat bread through most of time.
And since we're on the topic of homemade, as you mentioned, we do also make our own beers. And this reminds me of a question that I had that I still don't have a good answer for.
Oh, yes.
So when you buy commercially made beer, it's fizzy. And the way they put the fizz in it now is they sort of just inject carbon dioxide in. So it's sort of totally artificial.
And then they put it in containers.
And they put it in containers, cans, or bottles, or whatever. That keep the pressure. When homebrewing, you do it slightly differently. At the very last stage, you add a little bit more sugar, essentially, and then you put it in the bottle, sealed again, so that it holds the pressure. It ferments that tiny bit more in the bottle, which produces carbon dioxide, and that produces the bubbles in the beer. And that's why homebrewed beer, there's a little bit of sediment in the bottom of the bottles.
Leftover from the yeast its last, whereas commercial beer is filtered to get all of the residue of the yeast out, and then they add the bubbles artificially.
Now, my question is, before the invention of really tightly sealed vessels, how fizzy would you expect the beer to be? Now, I suppose if you drink it really fresh right out of the brewing vats, it would still have the carbon dioxide in it, and it would only slowly...
So it would be somewhat fizzy, not the high level of carbonation that, say, a Budweiser has, but it would have that tingly on the tongue fizziness. Yeah.
And presumably you're not storing the stuff for very long periods of time anyways, because it's just not going to keep in those kinds of conditions unless you have a way of sealing it. But if anyone knows about traditional brewing techniques...
Yeah, at what point in the history of beer did it start becoming the kind of fizziness that we expect of it now? And at what point did they start putting it in containers that could keep, that it could be pressurized at least a little bit?
Yeah, sealed enough. Is a cork enough to hold it in?
A cork with wax and rope on it, which I've seen suggested.
Yeah.
In a terracotta vessel. But yeah, we tried to find information on this. Like, we have records of beer brewing from the Sumerian period onwards. So there's lots of records of beer brewing. But first of all, lots of that beer is not beer that we would recognize now. It's brewed with different grains and different flavorings. It doesn't have hops until very late in the game. You know, no ancient beer has hops.
Yeah, it's really 16th century, I think, that this distinction between hopped beer and unhopped ale really
takes off. Yeah, so, I mean, we really wouldn't recognize a lot of what we still call beer from the ancient world as beer now. It wouldn't. It seems to have often been brewed and then drunk without being, for instance, strained, right? So you've got essentially sort of a porridgey, like the grains are still in it.
Yeah.
And as you say, often... you drink it very soon. But, you know, at what point does it sort of make that migration into something that we would recognize as a fizzy beer? And we couldn't find good sources. We tried to get some experts on it, but we didn't really get any good definitive answer for it, other than that certainly by sort of the mid-19th century, and then from then on, there's lots of stories about the attempts to get really good sealed vessels for holding that strong carbonation of artificial carbonation. But before that, we couldn't find good information about it, and I'd really like to know.
So let us know if you have any information on this.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good place to stop for tonight. I'm not going to try to replicate that run of puns at the end of the video. But suffice it to say that I think bread has been quite important, at least in European culture, for a very long time. And we should point out that lots of places in the world have never eaten bread, or as a traditional factor, of course. Those places that don't grow wheat never developed bread, leavened bread. And lots of other places didn't even really do a lot of baking of flatbreads or cakes or things like that. So it's not universal. But the places where bread has been eaten, it's been very important.
Indeed.
And I guess we'll just have to report back on our experiments with using beer yeast to make bread in a later podcast.
And in the meantime, we'll go back to loafing about.
I said we weren't going to do the puns. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
For more information on this podcast, check out the website www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits. We've also got all the ways you can follow us: Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, G+, a mailing list, and Instagram. And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project.
You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative. Our email is on the website, But the easiest way to get in touch with us is on Twitter. I'm at Avensarah, AVENSARAH.
And I'm at Alliterative.
To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on iTunes or to the feed on the website. And please review it on iTunes if you can and if you've enjoyed it. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.